3 of Neurolinguistics. Tonight's topic is learning how to listen. First night, Monday night, we had an overview of neurolinguistics and its uses for teachers, salespeople, medical people, and anybody else that talks to somebody. Narrows it down, right? I'd like to thank everybody for eating a light meal tonight so they can stay awake. We're a little alert tonight. That wasn't a funny joke. We all got enough rice, right? Enough energy to make it through the night. Okay. Let me briefly and quickly go through what was covered the first two nights. Start out with a little bit about myself, current practice in counseling in Auburn, Washington, south of Seattle, and been doing it for a number of years, approaching around 3,000 clients so far. I have to keep track of that number. Came out here last year to Holden on a visit, passing through, happened to meet Scott. Scott says, why don't you fill in a couple spots and tell us about what you do? And I did, without any notes, without any preparation. And must have done something right. He asked me back for a week. I agreed to come back for a week. Neurolinguistics is a new science, started in 1973. And it's been finding many, many new uses. Every day, it seems, there's a new list of books out on the reference library. It's the most current list of NLP books available. NLP means Neuro-Linguistic Programming. You'll be hearing a lot more about it, I'm sure, as it becomes more popular. There's no books in our reference library. There's no books in our library. And the books that I wanted to have over here in the bookstore didn't make it in time. So if you can, the place to order them and the list of the books available in the subject are on the wall. I forgot to mention that the first time, so I'm doing it right off the bat here this time. Okay. Applications and uses. First of all, a definition. Neuro, the neuro part of neurolinguistics, means the nervous system through which experience is received and processed via the five senses. Five senses being touch, voice, hearing, taste, smell, olfactory, visual, auditory, and kinesthetic. Kinesthetic meaning feeling, meaning emotions, also meaning gustatory, smell, and taste. Linguistics is the language and nonverbal communication system through which the neural representations are coded, ordered, and given meaning to whomever is receiving this information from the external world. Each one of us has codified what we've learned from birth and maybe even before birth, whatever your beliefs are. Each of us has a coded system of neural representations stored in our brain. Everything that we've experienced and received into our brain through our five senses, six senses, seven senses, intuition, and pre-birth wisdom, you believe in that? Has been stored somehow and codified in our brain. How we access that information and how we sort through this information that we've received into our senses depends on the person and how they have represented their view of the world. The ability to organize and communicate the neurological systems received through our sensory input, sorted and communicated back out, is what the linguistics portion of it is all about. Tuesday night, we talked a little bit about learning how we ourselves sort information from the outside world, how we take our sensory perceptions, file it away, how we represent it What is important to know about that is each of us has what we call a primary modality. Modality being one of visual, auditory, kinesthetic, gustatory, taste. A modality is a sensory ability to perceive something. Each of us has a primary modality. How do we know that? Is the result of the founders of neurolinguistics going through thousands and thousands of hours and thousands of people learning, codifying, storing, creating data and statistics that says most people work this way. The beauty of neurolinguistics is that someone who's trained in it can help a person learn, number one, about themselves and how they store information. Number two, how they take that information and project it out using their own codified language system. The body, being a somatic or cybernetic connection to the mind, also speaks to someone. When you talk, there's all parts of you that speak and communicate to somebody else. A frown, turned head, a glance, a movement. I don't know, this means something. I don't even have to say it. This means something, like I don't know what you just said, or I don't know the answer to it. All of you already have a way from your sensory-based input source of codifying all this information, not just the words. And in fact, neurolinguistics, the words that are spoken are not necessarily that important. All the sensory input that you get when someone communicates to you creates and usually fits into your own little comfortable level of primary-based modality. If you are a visual person and someone gives you a glance or goes like this or goes like this, that means a whole lot of things to somebody who is primarily visually sorting and filing away that information from the person. What somebody says and how they say it could be real, real important to somebody who is auditorily based, and their primary receptors from the external world are auditory. What people say to you or have said to you can be traced all the way back, even into the womb. You hear in the womb, I'm convinced. Each of you also leaves a communication or an input, a sensory input with a feeling. When this person did this to me and I asked them the question, I feel really inadequate. I feel like he didn't understand. I feel like that person's maybe stupid. I feel, I sense, I intuit that something happened when that person did this while I was trying to communicate to them. All this information, you're sorting. All your senses are working whenever you communicate. Lots of times, you know, we say to our children, didn't you hear what I just told you? Would you look at me when I'm talking to you? You're asking that person to fit into your modality system, you're forcing that person out of their system, which might be auditory, and making them look at you. Maybe that person doesn't want to look at you. When that person doesn't look at you, it tells you something. You're perceiving something, and you're filing it away, and you're creating a meaning for it that's individual and unique just to you. Nobody in this room has lived the same experiences, obviously. We've all been exposed to different situations, different people, totally different experiences. And each of you have codified those experiences in your own unique way. How does anybody learn to communicate with anybody? And we're all so unique in our own system that we created for ourselves of communication, both the visual, auditory, and kinesthetic, and the unspoken, the intuitive feelings that we are left with when we communicate with somebody. I'm going to ask all of you a couple of questions. I want you just to let your mind go blank and then come up with a response to these questions. best friend. If some of you pictured a face, heard a voice, or had a feeling, there's a clue there as to how you remember and sort and how you access what's been received. If there's a feeling, a voice, a face, or a picture, visual, auditory, or kinesthetic. The first, what we call accessing cue, or the first, what neurolinguistics call the first half-second rule. Where I go to find that information? Somewhere back here. Do I think a picture? Do I hear a sound? Do I have a feeling? Is where you sort and store and access what you've experienced in your life. Another question. Think of your favorite relative. You remember someone handing you a silver dollar? Pat on the back, kind word, a soft, smiling, warm, loving face. Each of you is sorting your own way, through your own coding system, through your own input. Think of your bedroom. Some of you might think, oh, relaxation, escape, freedom, sleep, renewal. Some of you might think, my beautiful handmade quilt of yellow, orange, and purple and green. Some of you might think of, well, there's a desk on the right, a closet in the front, and the bed on the left, and I walk into the room, and I can picture all these things. I hope this is indicating to you that people can think of the same word, the same question, in many, many different ways. Think of your favorite music. That's an auditory-based question. And this afternoon I asked it for the Narnia group at 3 o'clock. Somebody said, annoying. Somebody said, bright. Somebody said, really cool, dude. Everybody had a different idea of what, you know, the word music meant. Went around the room, who was your favorite teacher? One young lady said, guy with a tight jeans and a nice bun. Okay, that's enough of that. Favorite teacher. Okay, remember that teacher. No tight pants. Part of the process of counseling and therapy also deals with the sad parts of our memories, the difficult parts of our memories. The memories.
Could you repeat that last statement?
Part of neurolinguistics also deals with, and the part processing and therapy portion of neurolinguistics deals with the sad parts, the bad parts, the uncomfortable memories. Okay? Lots that I do with therapy has to do with phobias, with bad memories created in childhood somewhere along the line, child abuse, sexual abuse, a bad marriage, a bad relationship, a trauma. All those sensory inputs from those type of events are filed the same way through the sensory system. Therapy, using neurolinguistics, sorts through that person's representation of those incidences. Finds out how they relate to themselves as an adult. How the adult is listening to the experience, or seeing the experience, or feeling the experience many, many years ago. My favorite story is an 87-year-old man when he was 3 years old got into trouble with his father and recalled it with shivers and goosebumps and tears, just like that. The mind doesn't forget those things. The subconscious always has those things stored in your mind. Neurolinguistics gives you a tool for sorting back through those things, to reaccess those memories, to understand them now from an adult perspective or a new perspective, understanding where they came from, how they originated, how you, the adult, thinks about them, or how you, the adult, lets that child in you recall and control you, the adult. Yes, the memories that we have from our earlier life still control us sometimes. How many of you have a little voice that talks to you once in a while? Probably everybody. It's just part of the neurological system of the mind. Each of us has a different way of listening to that voice. Each of us either chooses to listen to it or not. NLP helps us, first of all, understand where these memories come from, and then allows you to understand them, and then allows you to have choice about those memories. Do you want to still be afraid of spiders? I don't know. Let's ask something earlier in your life. What reminds you of spiders? Go back into the subconscious and talk to the little boy, the little girl, and what they remember about it, because it's all still there in the subconscious. To recall any memories, file the way it's necessary for you to go through your mind and access certain distinct classes of past experiences put there by your sensory receptors. The internal search process you go through is called accessing. The process you sort to find answers is also used externally in your behavior to communicate. The same things that receive information also are used to project it. As you search for answers to some of the questions we just had, you actually break contact with the world around you very quickly and very instantaneously. Your mind shuts off, it goes inside, it sorts, comes back out with an answer. While you're sorting, part of your body structure gives you clues, or gives the listener who is tuned to you and is skilled in reading those somatic or body representations during this sorting process, can actually give you an answer before you even speak. Some of you would like to challenge that statement. I'll talk to you later. I can ask you a question, you don't even have to speak, and I can most likely find an answer for you by reading your physiology, by reading what's called the eye accessing cues, by reading the body, by reading flesh tones, tension in the lips, facial musculature, eye accessing movements, body language, Adam's apple. I'm not sure. Oh, tell me more about that. Where did you hear that? What do you see? What do you feel? What did you just hear? A lot of my therapy, in fact, is what I call content-free. I don't ever know what the person's thinking specifically. I can simply access through the body, find out what kind of representation they're accessing, and ask more questions about it, and let the person's internal representation system give the answers to them. Neurolinguistics is what we call a client-based therapy. I, the counselor, remain dumb as a stump and make no assumptions about anything that the body or the words that you choose to tell me mean or represent. because they are unique to you, and I have no idea what they mean to you. You will tell that to me. Very different sort of therapy. Very, very different. Psychologists don't like it, because we can change things in a matter of hours, and they like to have clients come back for months. $700 an hour or whatever. We're not comfortable with that.
You said that. I had this real gut-wrenching feeling in here, because I didn't agree with you.
We can talk later about it.
That was putting a whole group of people in one category.
I can't deny that it works, you know, over time.
Well, I wasn't questioning your therapy. I was questioning your statement that every psychologist is doing it for the money and for the prolonged therapy.
Good. You caught me in a gross overgeneralization, I apologize.
Now, how do you feel when I
you read my body language? I didn't have to tell you. Gross overgeneralization. Forget I said it. Find out for yourself. Eye movement indicates a person is searching and thinking for a word or words to reply to a question. Now you can even do this to yourself. Ask yourself a question, and you're going to sort the same way. Physiologically, you will sort the same way. Internal dialogue still reads on the surface. You have the little voice asking a question, you're going to do the same search. While you're talking to yourself, ever see a guy in the corner talking to himself? Ever see your boss? Ever see your boss in his office going? These are observable codes to the trained eye. These searching and thinking processes that goes on are discernible to the trained eye. Information about the structure of a person's inner world is all right there in front of you. You're already doing it now. You already have your own process and your own way of reading this information. Yes, ma'am?
I'm trying to formulate a question. Different people remember things differently. If you take any two people in any given situation, they're both going to remember that situation in light of their own particular need. Does it matter if a person in your treatment, if a person remembers something the way it really was, or is what is important is how they see it?
Good point. What they tell me most likely isn't the case. And what I mean by that, the words in some cases mean nothing until you sort it through, until they sort through and come to the true meaning. A fear of something may not be a fear of that object or insect or something. It may have something totally different to do with it. So far this week, there have been four people who have come up to me with phobias, and not one of them related specifically and directly to that particular. They have generalized, they have a precipitating incident in their life and made some kind of connections. A two-year-old made a connection with a five-year-old memory. A five-year-old memory made a connection with a nine-year-old's experience. And somehow this thing grew. The precipitating part of this thing maybe had nothing to do with what the adult part of them feels, thinks, or is sure is, in this case, you know, a phobia. So the words always have second meanings. They're metaphorical as can be. There's a thing in neurolinguistics called a red herring. People have a very well-tuned, safe way of hiding things, even from themselves and their conscious self. What their conscious thinks is very carefully hidden and masked in the subconscious. People who have especially been traumatized, and especially visually, I found, have a very well-tuned protective system. Some people will never, no matter what the question is, access visually. They won't allow, for Our subconscious will not allow them to even go back into visual memory of any kind until they know they're totally safe. They're so traumatized with visual input that I will never access or sort. There's that word never. Let's quantify that.
Is that what you're saying is that if they're, the person who is traumatized visually, if their asset sees something, they hear or they do another any other process or how?
Generally people,
the auditory or?
Yeah. Generally it sits down here. You ask a person who's been traumatized to recall a representation of it, they'll go right down into kinesthetic feelings.
So it's more
keep it right there. Yeah. There's processes and techniques to disassociate yourself from the feelings and allow yourself to watch yourself, whatever is going on, by disassociating the kinesthetic. In other words, put it up on a picture screen, put yourself in the audience, and move yourself aside. Watch yourself sit in the audience, watch this on the screen. That's generally how we'll find out. You know, by thinking it's safe for the person to do it, to look into whatever it is their subconscious won't allow them, associate it to look at. Too scary for them.
Thinking there's some recent cases about a child abuse that people had when they were children, but they have absolutely no recollection of it until they start in some therapy, and so they really suppressed it, and it seems incredulous that they can't have that memory.
My guess is that everybody in here has memories that their subconscious won't let them access on a conscious level. It's a protective device. God gives you a very balanced mind, and it's part of their protective device to not allow this thing to re-traumatize you or to re-excite you or to re-affect you in some way. You'll find a way of, the mind and the body finds a way of protecting itself. So you hide it. You find something else. You find a metaphor. You find something else that you attach to that thing. Okay, I'm going to you can imagine all kinds of things. My brother was run over by a car, so I'm going to hate cars really, really bad. Bad metaphor, but I'm saying it to give you an idea. You generalize and you move it on to something else. Sometimes, every situation is totally unique. Yes.
How does the justice system deal with that? Some people would make very poor witnesses.
They don't deal with it too well, I don't think. Not too many prosecutors or attorneys know neurolinguistics. If they did, it might make a difference in the justice system. And I mean that very sincerely. Just as though ministers, politicians, anybody in power, if they understood and had an audience that understood them and their subconscious and their somatic representations of things, might act and react differently if they knew that they were exposed. And people weren't just listening to words, they were mapping their body. Yes?
In your counseling and caring for your clients, is this a more direct and rapid way of getting to some answers for the client than would
all I can tell you is my own experience. I've never worked with a client more than 6 hours.
Is that because you're reading their physical reactions so fast that you can help them assess faster? Is that what you're saying? But the normal psychologist isn't as attuned to those
I think amazing things happen when you empower the client to answer their own questions and solve their own problems.
But that's what a psychologist does too. What makes your method faster?
That depends on the psychiatrist. I'm not evading the question, I don't have a good answer for you. I've never been in a therapist's office, a psychotherapist or a PhD therapist or anything like that. All I know is what I can tell you is what their methods are. Whether it's Adlerian, Jungian, Freudian, a lot of it's out of a textbook and it's not client-centered. I will take your situation and I will put you into my structured learned system of how to deal with this situation. And a lot of times they make a dramatic leap, leaving the client behind. And it takes a long time for the client and the therapist to come together and start understanding one another. Broad generalization, I admit. Yes?
I'm curious. You talked about the roles of learning and learning styles for teachers. Are you a visual learner yourself to begin this? I'm curious.
You'll have to watch me tonight and make your own decision.
Okay.
We've got a lot to cover tonight. I'd like to answer some more questions. I'm going to make myself real available out there for those kind of questions later on, but we've got lots to cover, and there never is enough time in the session. We've got lots to do. Part of our system is how our body projects information and communicates to another person. Obviously, a part of that is the words that we use to describe our system of what is represented in here. I ask all of you to think of the word chair, like we did Tuesday. We went around the room and had a pretty wide range of ideas of what a chair was. The descriptors, I call them descriptors, I don't even know if that's in the dictionary or not, I call them descriptors. People use words to describe how they have remembered and filed away information, whether it's visual, auditory, or kinesthetic. Let me read some words to you under visual that are descriptors that people use in their language and communication to take what is represented in their mind, how they sort it, and try to use this codified system of memory representations in a verbal, digital process called words. Remember, this is one part of communication. You know somebody, or you yourself use words like perspective, picture, look, vague, focus, clear, hazy, illuminate, scan, vision, bright, lighten up, blank, dark, imagine, clarify, colorful, pale, or dull. If that's part of your language, you might be saying a sentence like, I see what you mean. That looks good. The idea isn't clear to me. I'm just hazy about that. I just went blank. Let's attempt to throw a little light on the subject. I have a new perspective about things. I view it this way. Looking back on it now, it appears differently. That was an enlightening and insightful, colorful example of visual representation. Visual. Visual words, visual usage in language. I mean, that sounds like you talking, probably visually oriented person. Ask your spouse or your children if they recognize any of those words. They'll know. Auditory words are descriptors. Listen, quiet, noise, say, talk, tone, harmony, sounds, orchestrate, dissonance, click, resonate, loud, rings a bell, can't hear myself think, rumble, roared. On that note, we'll look at some auditory situations and sentences. I hear you, oh, that rings a bell, sounds good to me. Everything just suddenly clicked for me. Listen to yourself. That idea has been rattling around in my head for I don't know how long. Something tells me to be careful. I can really tune in to what you're saying. Some representative sentences, that sounds like you. You might think about how you receive information storm and how you might want to increase that and enhance that part of you, especially when you're asking somebody to clarify something or repeat that again or make that a little bit clearer. Right? Use those kind of descriptors. You probably are already, but knowing and using them consciously can make a big difference in how you communicate. Kinesthetic. Some words or descriptors: touch, smooth, grasp, handle, firm, warm, pressure, tremble, stir, penetrate, rough, cold. hard, fragmented, tapped into, a weight lifted, solid, blown away, moves me. Anesthetic sentences, feels good to do it, I got a handle on it. Did you grasp the basic concept? Get in touch with yourself, get a grip. I have a solid understanding, I'm up against a wall. Change your standpoint, you're so sensitive. I have a feeling you're right, I'm boxed into a corner. Any of those sound familiar? Nobody uses that stuff. We all use it in some way, shape, or form. Olfactory and gustatory, of course, have descriptors like stinks, pungent, scent, odor, whiff, relish, essence, inhale, savor, fragrant, sweet, delicious, bitter, a breath of fresh air, sour grapes, smell that a mile away. They're all predicate clues, descriptors as to how a person you're going to listen to and how you're going to hear yourself talk next time. To understand how and in what modality system you input and give out information and communicate to one another.
How would you respond to, as you read those different questions or different sentences, I found myself saying, well, I say that too. And I found myself saying things in all your categories and in many things from different categories. So, I mean, is it really possible that someone could exist in many different modalities and not necessarily one form of thinking or one form of...
Yes, most people begin with their favorite, most comfortable, best feeling, best sounding, greatest looking modality. They sort through everything because you have seven senses or five senses or six senses feeding in all this information to you. The question is asked of you of a sensory input that requires you to build a memory by accessing and sorting through all this information about whatever it is it asks you about. You'll sort through the same sensory input to find that output. And what I'm suggesting is that most of us have a primary or first accessing modality. You have an exit modality when there's a question given to you, you'll access it. I see the picture, yeah, that sounds right. God, I'm not sure that that's, I don't feel that's right. Let me see. Yeah, the picture is right. That sounds good. The answer is such and such.
It sounds kind of like a wreck.
Yeah. People will start out, oh man, this doesn't feel good. Let's see. If I see this, he's going to, can make this picture better for me and then I'll feel good about it. The answer is such and such. And this happens at that. The IAC computers are just that fast. This afternoon with some of the children, we had one young lady who just went all over the place and thoroughly sorted everything. Find out what she didn't like about her brother. We found some things you did like about it. So yes, the process of inputting through all five senses and communicating out through all five senses is called synesthesia. Again, there's usually a primary input modality and a primary exit modality.
And they're not necessarily the same.
Not usually. I would say, well, I don't know. That's up to the client. You're forcing me to generalize. I have to stay dumb as a stump. It's driven into me over years of practice and training. The point of this whole thing is that we cannot separate our mind from our body. When you're asked these questions, your body will represent and try to communicate outside world, whether you want to or not. In our practice, we have people who've been doing it and have this pounded in their heads for years. Sit up as guinea pigs in front of the room. You know darn well what he's going to ask you. You know where you're darn well the eyes are going to go up over here, but try to stop yourself. Mind and body are connected. Your eyes will sort whether you try to stop it or not. Even if you look straight ahead and be focused, you're going to go like this, you're going to go like this, you're going to go like that. You're going to go like this. You're going to go everything tells you something about how they're processing and how they're going to communicate to you, and where they're going to communicate to you from, the predicates they're going to use, the sentences they're going to form, and the answers they're going to give you are almost predictable. Almost. I didn't generalize that.
Do you ever use this in, say, if someone is extremely depressed and grieving and reading problems?
Boy, do we ever use it in that? Probably 60% of my business. And most counselors and therapists.
Do you treat people with eating disorders? And do you have treatment success? Mm-hmm. I mean, in psychiatric, it's 3 to 5 treatment.
Yeah. Eating disorders is one of the toughest, and I don't do it in my practice. That takes many, 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 many years to be successful at, because eating disorders are a culmination, in my opinion, my humble opinion, of so many sensory input memories, and so many interactions with the external world, and so many sorts that they have to go through that causes that person to eat, or feel about themselves, or whatever. It's just a real complicated issue. Some of these things that are on the market to stop, you know, overeaters or to control weight, boy, I just have real doubts about them. Because it's a very complex, that issue is a very complex issue. And I don't feel qualified even after all those patients and this much time to work with it. Not too many enough peers do. And not too many psychiatrists, but they're honest.
But there are some NL people that do attempt to work in
the mostly in conjunction with hypnosis. Cognitive regressive hypnotherapy, and hypnosis, hypnotherapy, generally in conjunction with that, because to sort through all the input representations that make a person an overeater, it takes a lot of careful calibration and analysis. Typical to do, and then you don't know if you got a red herring because it's a really well-protected system. Usually, I mean, and even in the subconscious, there are protectors that, you know, hide the real reason, the cause. I don't deal with it that much, but I can't give you a good answer.
Excellent.
Sure.
Is there a two-point question? Number one, is there potential misuse of this form of program in the sense of control and you know, like they had to protect the misuse of psychological forms of treatment, and then there's a specific code of ethics that the APAs.
The only answer to that is that you can't, even under hypnosis, make somebody do something you don't want them to do. NLP keeps and will work very hard to keep the choice, the client, not the therapist. They work very hard at that. Generally, it's really easy to do because it's a client-centered form of catharsis or interaction or communication. One of the other ways, since this is part in communication here, and the subject tonight was, and we're getting around to it with 15 minutes left, it's all part of the same thing.
It's all interesting.
Part of good listening comes from creating rapport with somebody. Knowing what we've just talked about now, about how we sort and how we move things out, what would you guess would be the best way to listen to somebody? You would want to use, first of all, the clues that they give you visually, somatically, their body expression, the predicates and descriptors that they use. And somebody says, everything you tell me is just so crystal clear and beautifully wonderful, just lovely looking. You're going to say, get a grip on this thing. Really, you know, just get a handle on this thing. You're not listening to me. You know, you might not, you know, somebody's going to be there, you're going to be there, and you're going to talk. Thanks, goodbye, nice talking to you. People choose their friends subconsciously by how well they establish rapport with one another. Likes seem to attract, especially in communication. Visuals find friends who are visual. Not always. I won't generalize. People are more comfortable with people who communicate in their own private, comfortable modality, in their own individual system. What they sort and how they communicate, if they're not, you know, if you're talking visual and, you know, I'm talking just kinesthetic all the way here, never the two shall meet, two ships in the night.
How come those offices marry each other then?
To learn about one another. To balance themselves. One of the great things I really enjoy is marriage counseling. I have two couples come in and, you know, some reason, usually it's the woman who is visually oriented, the man is kinesthetically oriented. Not always, but, you know. But they're working in different modalities. Once you tune them both in to where they're coming from and how they're sorting their information and how they're finding a way and how they're talking to one another and how they expect to be heard and how they talk to you and how they expect to be listened to and understood, you know, get the two of them together and create better communication. You know, I understand that you're visual and I understand this is what's important. That's why you've never heard what I've told you. Because you never showed me. Make a picture, will you? Don't tell me something. Make a picture. Draw it out for me. Why don't you get a grip on this stuff? I haven't seen the meaning of it yet. You should ever talk to me at my level. Lots of different ways that two people just, you know, try real hard but never get it together. What I'm suggesting to you is, here's a system, here's a way, first of all, to understand yourself and to understand how people talk to you. Shifting yourself into their modality for pacing, mirroring, and matching to create rapport. Pacing means to, if a person talks real fast and you really just, you know, they just can't really get the stuff out fast enough, and you really, you know, just, I gotta tell you this stuff, it's really great. And you're saying, oh, really? Oh, yeah, well, we could talk about it. Two ships in the night. Matching somebody means matching their predicates. Crystal clear vision of this beautiful, lovely rainbow of representation. Use the same predicates back to them, see what happens. Pacing, leading, mirroring even their body, postures, and images. A person talks to you this way. You know, I just really feel good about this. You're going, oh, tell me about it, tell me about it. You're saying, oh, you do, tell me about it. Drop your head and move, match. Create what we call a rapport with that person. Let them know that you're listening. By mirroring, matching, pacing, and even leading that person who is visual to use kinesthetic phrases. This thing looks really crystal clear to me. Well, help me get a handle on that. How would you feel about that if you could explain it to me in a different way? Pace that person into your modality. Help that person communicate and access some information from their comfortable mentality. They can do it. Force them to communicate with you so you understand better. By saying, hey, you know, I need to get a handle on this, and you're up here in the clouds, you know, just stop it. I can't understand what you're saying. Come down to earth, get grounded, give me something more concrete, give me some hard facts. Challenge the person to come back and to work in your modality where you're comfortable with it. All the different clues that are available for you, called the physical. We talked about color, breathing, lip size, defocusing, eye twinges, eye access and cues. And again, for those, just very briefly, when you're looking at the person's face that's talking to you and their eyes go up to the side or down. This is the visual, this is the auditory, and this is the kinesthetic. The This is the person's face that you're looking at. You ask them a question and their eyes go up. Let's see. I think I got a picture of that. It's like when they're sorting in the visual system. They may go, here's the answer. I see it, it feels right. If I say it, it's going to be okay. This is how it sounds, say it. Boom, like that. First half second tells you everything you need to know about where they're coming from and how they're going and what they're going to tell you before they say it. Visual, accessing cues, body posture, predicates that they use, and creating a rapport by feeding back to them their system, feeding back to them and mirroring their posture. They give you a quizzical look. Let's talk. Let that person know. Give them the visual clues that you're in fact tuned into them, that you see exactly what they say and you feel exactly as they do. Salesmen who know how to do this stuff can sell refrigerators to Eskimos. It's not manipulation, because the person is coming from their representational system. All I am doing, when I create rapport with that person, give them what they're most comfortable in. You're not going to sell a car to somebody who is visual by saying, feel that leather. What does that acceleration feel like for you? Notice how it takes those curves. You're going to say, what a great color car this is. Look at the interior. Look at how it glistens. Not manipulation, it's what the person's comfortable in, and that's how they make their decision. Understand that. Create rapport, create trust, create understanding, create good listening. Let's see. Just covered about 2.5 years worth of study in the 15 times. How did I do? Any questions? Yes?
You mentioned you worked with children this afternoon. What is the minimum level of age that this procedure, this system works?
Because neurolinguistics is an auditory-based, language-determined system, they have to be able to understand the meanings of the words. They have to know that a dog means something to them, or a house, or a cat, or a car, or pain, or hurt.
Is this generally in the area of 4 to 6, or 6 to 8?
Yeah, I think the youngest I've ever worked with is 3.5.
I have taken the modality tests. I don't remember which one it was, and I've also administered them to my students. And I kind of question the validity. How do you feel about the validity of tests that
Given them a modality test. Maybe afterwards you can show me a little bit more about it. I can't answer because I don't know what that test is.
Well, at SBU, there's a class where you take, and you're given the modality test in the class. And then
whose modality
that
test?
I can't tell you the name right now. I don't remember which test. And then that same test you can use.
I won't tell you the name because I don't know.
Is that that one page? It's been about 6 years since I took that class, but it seems like it was one long.
Ask questions like, what temperature do you like to be warm or cold, things like that.
Yeah, and it's to help you with determining the learning styles in your classroom.
Do you remember things you see or do you remember things you hear?
I think as a teacher, it works better just to go around the room and ask people to give you their representations about things, and I'll tell you real quick. The test means, to me, again, my opinion.
That's my feeling too. I think it's very expensive.
My opinion is, let's see, what should I write down that the teacher wants to hear?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's the right answer. I know that's.
It kind of seems like an expensive gimmick to use the test.
Yeah, it could be. Somebody's making money on it. You got it.
You ever use repetitive dreams to trace back?
Right. Dreams often create metaphors for us. Again, lots of red herrings in dreams. You know, one thing that we dream about may mean something totally different. The representation of a house in the dream may have any number of determinations or meanings or subtleties or lead you off into a wild goose chase sometimes. I tend to stay away from dreams because what we're working with here primarily is conscious perceptions filed in the memory, processed in the subconscious, reaccessed from the subconscious to the conscious. That's the process. Dreams originate from the subconscious and could mean, in my opinion, anything. Sometimes they have lots of meaning. And sometimes in therapy you'll go into a representation in a dream. We just did it a couple nights ago. Representation in the dream, really wasn't what it was all about.
Does the
theory
of right left brain
assume
about the way they access
this? Yeah, it's part of the sensory system. And again, it goes into what I call instinctual wisdom. That's my name for it. You know, whatever your DNA and past life or inherited biological, you know, that's all part of the process that you utilize. But again, not until you, in this body, in this plane, sort through with these eyes and this brain that you create these memories that we can pull from the subconscious or conscious and process and understand differently. And it's kind of, it's been easy for me to tell whether it's been a dream state, an experienced, associated experience. In other words, this person really lived through it, or it's something they saw on a movie screen and believe it happened to them. You can tell the difference, whether it's been an associated experience, sensory experience, or whether it's been a disassociated sensory experience.
Why the physical cues that go with them? How do you tell?
Depends on the client. Depends on how they represent it and how they bring it forth and how they communicate it. You know, it's different for everybody. Yeah, that's a good answer. It's just different for everybody. Everyone's unique. Everyone processes their information totally differently. Yeah.
So my understanding you to say that the basic benefit that we as just people with a very brief introduction to this would have is that when we talk to someone, they will feel like they're being heard, and they will feel like we are listening to them, and that will allow them to communicate with us.
Not just them, but you too.
I will feel like I'm listening to them.
You will feel the rapport if they feel the rapport. You will know whether you're over here and that person's over here. You know, they may be able to tell you that, you know, you really understand me. And that's going to make you feel, oh no, I don't. What do you mean by that? Or you can say, yeah, I do. I understand you. You know, you will know, is what I'm saying. You will know because you will both tell each other somehow, way, shape, or form. Yes?
That's similar to reflective listening. When you say something, and what I would say after you said it would be how I perceived you saying it. I mean, like, I heard you say such and such and such and say it.
Sounds like a neat term. I mean, there's thousands of things, you know. There's as many individual descriptors of this process as there are Freuds and Erikson's and Adler's and Jung's.
And some people have been doing this instinctively.
You all have been. You all have done this. You all have your own system, believe me. You are doing it right now. When you watch me and you wonder, why did I just rub my nose and wipe my nose, what does that mean? You're all, you know, and you're filing this stuff away subconsciously. The conscious part of you hears what I'm saying, hopefully. The subconscious part of you is reading all kinds of stuff into it. You do it all, every day with everybody you meet, And even listening to your own internal, this is real important, your own internal dialogue. You are creating your own memory, an individually based representation of your own internal dialogue. That little boy or that little girl, and he just said that. I can't believe it. What does that mean? Oh, probably means this. I guess I'll do that.
But I've also, I can also say, I perceive it this way, but I choose, I'm going to make a decision to act on it.
Good point. Let me conclude by saying that neurolinguistics, the whole process here, the client-based process, is one of client empowerment. Empowerment of the adult conscious you to choose, big word in neurolinguistics, the right, the God-given right, to choose what you want to listen to, how you want to remember it. Do you want that three-year-old's experience that keeps firing up back here, that little internal tape that runs along? I burnt my hand, I can't stand this anymore. That person said that to me when I was 5 years old, and he just said it to me again, and it sounds an awful lot like what you told me, Dad, when I was 3 years old, and I'm not going to like you. Consciously being aware of it at an adult level gives you choice, because it enlightens you as to perhaps where it came from, how it was processed, how you're working this through your mind. Enlightening you at a conscious level to say, look, you little three-year-old snot. Shut up. I'm an adult. I want to drive my bus this time. Leave me alone. Choice is where it all comes down to. An adult choosing by perceptive, conscious recognition of whatever the decision that has to be made, whatever the empowerment you're looking for, whatever the want you need, whatever the thing you want to get rid of, whatever it is you want to understand but can't. In my next sessions, we're going to go into different parts of the subconscious and learn about how the internal dialogues happen inside our mind from the NLP's perspective. I think we have to cut off.